cases where courts are looking at the other side of that. But do you have a case to cite where this has been upheld?
Where a university, well, certainly the Sixth Circuit's original panel decision.
I'm not, but that didn't have, that's not the law of the Sixth Circuit, right? Is there a case where this has actually been upheld?
No.
No. Okay, so what she did is something that no court has ever said, finally, is okay.
And no court has ever said is not.
There we have to get into to what we think the Supreme Court was talking about in Rosenberger and in other cases where they've looked at student press. But could I ask you just for one other clarification? Most of your argument seems to be on what I would call the second part of the Saussure against Katz analysis, whether the law was clearly established enough to overcome the qualified immunity of the person. Am I correct that you are really not contesting the first part of this, that in fact university newspapers such as the one at Governor's State do enjoy First Amendment protection, and that taking all of the facts most favorable to the plaintiffs, as we have to at this point, clearly they may not wind up that way, but taking the facts in that light, that there would be a violation, and we're really looking at part two of this analysis?
No, not only that, Your Honor. On the record here, no reasonable jury. Again, it's important to note that this case does not present content-based censorship.
But what it presents is absolute censorship. In taking the facts most favorably to the plaintiffs, Ms. Carter calls the printer and basically says, you're not going to get any money for the paper unless somebody has looked at it. And I realize that's a contested fact, please. I mean, don't, but she doesn't say that she said that. But that's, if you cut off the press at the print source, and of course no commercial printer has any particular reason to want to print for free, that's the absolute censorship.
No, Your Honor, this is about prior review. It's not about content-based censorship. Certainly,
well, but prior review is, what else is it? Aren't we quibbling over words here?
No, Your Honor, not in the least. No, content-based censorship arises when there's a denial of access to the forum based on the content. When a university says, as it says in Kincaid en banc, you can't distribute this document, this yearbook, or the in Brown, the thesis, you can't, we restrict your right to distribute or to use this thesis. But here, what we're looking at is we want to, the university said only, we want to look at this before it's printed. And certainly the university has a right to prohibit pornography, to prohibit obscenity, so it must have the right to look ahead in order to know whether the speech is protected in the first place. Now, this is
when you say we and you, who do you mean? Are you conceding for this purpose that the publication is an entity distinct from the university?
No. And that's part of the school sponsorship.
Your brief describes the newspaper as being published by an entity that seems different from the university. It's something the Student Communication and Media Board.
Right.
What is the Student Communication and Media Board?
That is the entity within the university which has faculty members, which has student members, which acts as the publisher. But this is part of the forum analysis. And forum analysis.
Wait a minute.
Here's my problem. As soon as you say the publisher is something other than the university, then I don't see how the university has any ability to come in and stop the publication. It's the publisher who is obligated to publish. Forget newspaper for a second. Suppose this entity were the Good News Club, mm-hmm. or a religious organization. Could the university say you can't disseminate your religious newspaper till you've persuaded us it's a good one?
Your Honor, that would be, it would depend on school sponsorship. That's the crux of...
Think of Rosenberger.
Yes.
There's a separate organization, an organization different from the university, a student activities board. It grants money to this religious organization, and the Supreme Court says at that point it's a completely distinct entity from the university, and the university can't squelch it, and it can't withhold the money either.
That's not true.
So my question to you is, why is this any different from that?
In Rosenberger, the question was, on whether the...
Don't quibble with my understanding of Rosenberger. Address my question, which is, why is this any different from that?
Because the speech in Rosenberger was not school-sponsored because it doesn't have the indicia of school sponsorship, which includes, for example, in this case, the SCMB, the Student Media Board, must sign off on the payment, as Ms. Hossie testified. The university, through Dean Carter, must sign off on payment to the
printer. Who appoints the members of the board?
I'm sorry?
Who appoints the members of this board?
My understanding is that it's the university.
The students as well. I know there's I know there are faculty members as well, but does the university appoint the students also?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I don't know that the record tells us that. But the crux of the amount of control that any government-created forum has turned.
Let me ask my question in a different way. Do you conceive of the newspaper itself as state action? That is the Student Activities Board an entity of the state of Illinois for purposes of all the things that follow from it being a state actor?
I think that the university certainly thinks of itself that way, and that's what you have to look at.
No, what about the board, though?
I'm sorry?
Does the university think of the board that way?
Student Communication and Media Board, is it a state actor?
In the 1983 sense, do you mean?
Hmm?
I think it would depend on the circumstances. In these circumstances, for example, if the newspaper had a defamatory article, I am sure that the defamed person would sue the student.
I'm not asking what lawyers would do. I'm asking whether, in your view, it's a state actor. I can put the question a different way. Suppose the Student Communication and Media Board decides to publish a religiously oriented newspaper. Would that be prohibited by the First Amendment on the ground that the Student Communication and Media Board is a state actor, part of Governor's State University?
Well, I think that's similar to Rosenberger, except different in that in Rosenberger, what the court
said. Maybe my question isn't clear. I'm trying to figure out what is the status of the Student Activities and Communications Board. Mm-hmm. This is not a question about Rosenberger. If it's a state actor, presumably it couldn't publish a religiously oriented newspaper, and then presumably it might be some part of the Governor's State University. But if it's an independent organization, if it's acting on its own behalf, then, if it's really an independent publisher of the newspaper, then what Governor's State University is doing looks like censorship of an independent organization. How to characterize what this entity is and what its relationship is to the university is, at least in my view, very important. That's why I'm trying to get you your understanding of what it is.
Well, I think these questions go to the issue of school sponsorship. And
so you're basically saying, according to your view of school sponsorship, if Ms. Hossie and Ms. Porsche and the others were all devoted Christians and they were the editors of the paper and they said, we're going to make the innovator a forum for discussion of Christian theology and not any other, not Muslim or not anything else, you would say they're not permitted to do that.
I think Rosenberger would say whether.
Would you say that?
No, I mean they wouldn't. They couldn't do it. They couldn't do it as a school newspaper because of an establishment clause problem, I don't think. And they couldn't do it as a non-school sponsored paper because of Rosenberger. I mean
What?
Rosenberger says you can't have a Christian club.
You've got Rosenberger backwards.
No, Rosenberger says that you can't have viewpoint discrimination.
That the school can't engage in viewpoint discrimination, but that funds from the school can go to an entity which is not itself a state actor, which can then speak as it wants. And for the school to try to censor or prohibit that violates the First Amendment. That's the holding of Rosenberger. Now, it may be that by parallel reasoning, what's being done here violates the First Amendment. But if I'm right, if it's an independent thing that the school is trying to squelch, but if it's all really part of Governor's State University, if Governor's State is the publisher, we might think about it differently. So we need to know what this is.
This is the newspaper of Governor's State University. The advisor reviews it for libel. Obviously, the university...
No, but there's a disputed issue of fact about what the advisor's role is. Some facts in the record say that the advisor looks at it but has no decision-making authority at all, could say this is the most libelous article I've ever read, and the students could go ahead and publish it. You're saying, so I'll assume there's evidence in the record to the contrary, that the advisor, in fact, has a veto. But the question whether there's an advisor veto strikes me on this record as a disputed one.
Well, Your Honor, certainly the university cannot be forced, cannot be compelled to sponsor libelous matters.
But the university, this is funded anyway by student funds, but this gets back to Judge Easterbrook's point. If the students are publishing this thing as an independent publication, then presumably the university would also have a defense against libel. I don't know, but my point is only that you're saying the advisor has a veto. I'm saying it looks to me on this record that, structurally speaking, there is a disputed issue of fact about that.
Even if there were a disputed issue of fact about whether the paper is school-sponsored or not, whether it's a non-public forum or a limited public forum, it's surely not a public forum because it's not the Boston Common, it's not a park, it's not a street. Under a limited public forum, certainly that the university can review, can restrict speech, can review if it has even a compelling interest.
If it's the university's forum at all, but even non-public fora have a great deal of autonomy, even if they're state-funded, as we know from the Arkansas Educational Television case. That was a non-public forum, purely government-funded, but they were allowed to restrict who participated in the debate because of who was actually sponsoring that particular political debate. So it strikes me that public forum analysis isn't... The question is who gets into the forum, not or who makes the decisions once you've established the forum about what's there. And if it's the students, as much of this record seems to indicate, then it's not the university.
Well, certainly, I mean, the university created the newspaper. The university is the newspaper of Governor State University wouldn't exist if the university hadn't created it. The question here is how much, whether you use the reasonable, reasonableness test of the non-public forum or the compelling interest, the more stringent standard that's used for a limited public or even a public forum. And here, certainly, the university has educational interests. Student newspapers are intended as a learning laboratory for students to learn journalism and ethics and so on.
But nobody has to take a class. This is quite different from Hazelwood, and I think that the effort to stretch Hazelwood over to this context is a strained one at best. But this isn't like the Journalism 2 class in Hazelwood. This is just a separate entity.
No, Your Honor, Hazelwood doesn't turn on whether it's a class. It turns on whether it's an educational experience and there is faculty supervision.
And there isn't.
Well, clearly there's an advisor. There's a difference. There may be a difference.
The facts are completely different from Hazelwood.
Well, even if this is not a sponsored, even if there were enough evidence, we don't think there is, if there were enough evidence to show that this were, there isn't enough evidence, if there were not enough evidence to show that this is school-sponsored and thus a limited, that's a non-public forum, under the limited public forum analysis, you still, the university can exercise authority when it has compelling interests, and they're narrowly tailored. Here,
but Ms. Carter said she just wanted to make sure the commas were put in the right place. She says grammatical. That's not a compelling interest.
Your Honor,
please.
The university has a number of interests with regard to the newspaper. One is that it is the teaching function of it, to teach students ethics, to teach them journalism, to teach them writing skills. And we know from the single issue in the paper that function is not being served by the review that it was getting from the faculty advisor.
Was Judge Conlon completely off the wall when she observed in her opinion that the student editors and writers were given complete editorial control over the newspaper, including its subject matter and content?
What the media board policy says is that the media board will not exercise control or prior approval. And there's not, again, we have to know.
So you think Judge Conlon was just wrong in that sentence?
She overstated the policy. What we need to look at here.
What do you mean by understated, Chief?
What do you mean by overstated? Because the policy says that the media board does not have prior content approval power. But it doesn't say that the university administration does not. I think what we have to do is look here at the Mueller case, because that really seems to be the most applicable here. And Mueller had to do, as here, with prior review, and there of non-school-sponsored speech, of absolutely private speech, of students bringing in documents for distribution. And what this court said, both in the majority opinion and in the dissent, is that when that a school can in fact impose prior review on for even private speech because post hoc remedies can be inadequate. Now here what we have
but is the context is quite different in that case.
The context is different, but the
age of the students, the whole.
And so you would look at different things to show whether to determine whether the post hoc remedies were inadequate. Now here a post hoc remedy for say a libelous article would obviously be inadequate. The damage would be done. The libel would be
inadequate. Why is it inadequate? I mean, equity isn't the only way that people remedy libel cases. Normally damages are solved.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The university would be held liable or certainly would be dragged into the litigation. And also, when you have a post hoc remedy for ethical violations, for the substantial ethical violations that one of the amici found in the issue that's in the record. Conflicts of interest, writing about your own teacher, having your advisor writing articles. I mean, these are very basic journalism ethics problems that occurred in a single issue. And so this kind of thing sullies the university's reputation in a way that is simply not able to be remedied in a post hoc sort of way. That's why the university only wanted to look. There is nothing in the record, absolutely nothing in the record, to show that Dean Carter's call was motivated by a concern about content.
So what would she have done? Everything you have said suggests that if, upon looking, she had discovered these ethical lapses or other things, she would have pulled the issue, or she at least would have pulled the article. Why? She doesn't want to make a pointless gesture, I assume.
Your Honor, we don't know what she would have done, and that's why the notion of being a content-based prior restraint claim is premature. We don't know. All she might have done was say, look, you're saying mitigate when you mean exacerbate. You're saying legislate when you mean litigate. You correct these words and everything will be fine. She might have said that. And when you're talking about a prior review like this, as one of the cases we cited, Harless says, you have to consider the limiting construction that was given with the request for prior review. And here there is absolutely no dispute, factual dispute, that Dean Carter said, I want to look at this for punctuation, spelling, and the like. She did not say, and if I see an article about X, I'm going to...
So none of your rationale actually fits what she was doing. Your rationale is all this stuff about ethics and teaching and university's reputation, libel, and all the rest of it. But in fact, that's a poor fit for these facts, isn't it?
I'm saying that this is a perfect fit for these facts because the university's reputation has to do with
what. Not with the grammar and spelling. You're giving me this grandiose set of justifications, and Dean Carter had a very modest set, you're saying.
But those are interrelated. The university's reputation certainly is sullied when the university's newspaper is error ridden.
Okay.
We ask the support. Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Wells. Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My privilege as pro bono counsel to have an opportunity to speak on behalf of the student appellees and the amici, which we represent groups dedicated to journalism.
Has the dean approved all the spelling and punctuation in your brief?
I think I might be in trouble on that, Your Honor.
So what relief are the plaintiffs seeking?
Your Honor, the plaintiffs sought injunctive relief and declaratory relief, and along with money damages under a
1983. Well, what could they get money damages for?
And Your Honor, I apologize, I'm a little bit handicapped in terms of not being counseled record to the students below, but as I understand it, in terms of their 1983 claims, that there would be the ability to recover money damages.
For what? For what?
Well,
what was the injury? I mean, what was the injury?
The injury to their First Amendment rights, their ability to publish the student newspaper in these contexts.
Were they prevented from publishing it?
Absolutely, they were prevented from publishing, Your Honor, by the actions of Dean Carter, as the court pointed out in the prior questioning.
I don't understand you.
The conduct by Dean Carter was clearly an absolute...
Well, as I understand what happened, but correct me if I'm wrong, they decided not to submit any issues to her.
After
any copies to look at, is that correct?
The dean's call to the publisher, Your Honor, my understanding of the record is that there is some dispute about what actually happened after those calls in October of 2000, and really, I think it was clear, given what the publisher, Mr. Richards, and Mr. Beattie had said, this paper was not going to be published, it was not going to be printed, and while no actual newspapers were actually submitted to the printer, I think it was very clear, given the conduct, given the circumstances, given what the publisher had said, it would not have been printed, that the act, that the conduct by the dean was that absolute prior restraint.
Counsel, what is your understanding as a matter of Illinois state law about the status of this media board? Is it part of the university, or is it a private organization funded by the university?
It's an excellent question, Your Honor. And I think if you look at the policy for student media for Governor State, which is in the record, and it very clearly articulates the answer to the court's earlier questions about this Student Communications Media Board being the publisher of this newspaper and all other student media. I think if you look at the terms, and while it doesn't say so explicitly, it appears very clear from the policy this is not a state actor. It's not a part of
who appoints the members.
The members are appointed. It does talk about membership, Your Honor, and the membership to this board are appointed by the student senate. And it talks about who the, I mean, if you look at the policy...
The students appoint the faculty members?
And again, not being at Governor State, if I'm just reading the policy on its face, it appears to indicate just that. These members will be appointed by the Student Senate as follows, including the faculty members.
Has there been any decision by Illinois courts that you know of about whether this entity is a private entity funded by the university or the university? That is, I mean, they have a student outing and a car runs over a stranger. Who's liable?
Your Honor, and again, I've not looked at that particular issue. I'm not aware of cases. There may be. I'm not aware of it. What I looked at in connection with this student media board and how this university operated its student media, including the innovator, was on the issues, and I think, again, from the court's earlier questions, that it turned over all editorial control to the students. That's what the policy says. And
what
did
it say about the faculty advisor, or is that just ad hoc? Or
with respect to the advisor, it really doesn't get into the specificity. It says the staff, meaning the staff of, in this case, the innovator, will determine content and format of their respective publications without censorship or advance approval, period. In this particular case, and Your Honor, quite frankly, the innovator operated just like most...
Well, what is the basis of the faculty advisor? Is it just something the students... Do the students select the faculty advisor?
In terms of that, Your Honor, I'm not honestly sure how that happens in terms of how that advisor is chosen.
But on this record, it seemed that, in fact, someone in the university changed advisors to the disgruntlement of the students. So maybe somebody else furnishes the advisor for them.
I think in this particular case, Dean Carter ended up firing the advisor. But I think.
But from the whole university, right? Or just from the... Was he leaving, or...?
His status may have been in flux. I think the important aspect of what the advisor does and the innovator in this media and others is they provide advice. When the editors went to that person and asked for advice, they were able to take it or not with respect to whatever the question was.
Like if I were the advisor to the University of Chicago Law Review, I could tell them I thought an article was poor, but if they liked it, they'd print it anyway.
I think to the extent that it falls under policies like this, Your Honor, I think that's exactly what that advisor's role was there, to provide some advice, but not to provide the kind of censorship or prior review. And in fact, the record's very clear that the advisor in this case acted along the lines of the policy, providing advice that the editors would from time to time, not mandated to go to, but would from time to time seek out their advice. and without this censorship or advance approval.
So there's no language in this policy that says they must run every issue past the advisor before it can be sent to the printer.
There's no mandate like that, Your Honor. And in fact, most student newspapers that I'm aware of, that the amici are aware of, operate exactly that way. They're not mandated. It's a part of an advice process, but not mandated. Certainly not required. They could have simply chosen not to in any particular instance and could certainly choose to accept the advice or not.
But what about the university's interest in not being sued for libel or for other things? It's not that this thing is an utterly unrelated entity to Governor's State. The university surely does have some interest in what goes out under its, broadly speaking, under its name.
You're right, Your Honor. There's going to be some interest on behalf of this university and any others with respect to their student publications. But I think the question was raised earlier. I think it's the right one. What lawyers do or not do ultimately with respect to the liability issue, if there is an issue of defamation or libel from an article published in The Innovator, we would submit, and I think counsel for the university would say, we have no liability. We have no exposure for this libel. It's the students, the student editors, and the Student Communications Media Board that would be on the point defending that defamation case.
What connection, are there any journalism students or grading connected with this?
There's not, Your Honor, and again, I think it's very important for the court to understand, I think the panel understood it very well, that what happens at the college and university level is very different from high school, very different from Hazelwood. This has nothing to do with the journalism class. It has nothing to do with the communications program. This is a separate, independent student publication.
Some colleges and universities don't have newspapers that are operated as a part of the journalism program, isn't that true?
I think most, in fact, what our research has shown, and I believe we may even have some of this in the amici brief, is that most student publications at the college and university level operate independently of the school's journalism department or communications department. That's not to say that students in those fields would want to work on the paper, certainly, but it's not a part of the curriculum. In Governor's State, the interview is clearly not part of it.
Well, my impression of facts, maybe this is wrong or unsettled, is that there was no faculty advisor at some point, and Dean Carter, because there was no faculty advisor, said she wanted to look at the issue. Ordinarily, it would be the faculty advisor, but he had left or been fired or what have you. So is that correct?
Your Honor, as I understand the facts and the record, what happened in the fall of 2000 was the student advisor, Mr. Laka Forde, I believe, was not on the campus premises, but he was still operating as the advisor, and that these student editors were able to email him, that there was a computer provided for him so that he was available to them, and certainly available by phone and otherwise, but available by email and contact and was continuing to operate. I think there's something in the record that the state tries to argue that he was 4 hours away to try to make some sense of rationalizing or supporting what Dean Carter did.
But isn't there something else, though? If Dean Carter had simply said, I want to be the one to whom you can come if you feel like it, we would have something more analogous to at least your description of what the advisor was. When she escalates it and says, you must come to me, isn't she changing the role?
Absolutely, Your Honor. She changed the role, and she did.
Why do you say that? Why do you say that? I thought the faculty advisor always read the newspaper.
Again, Your Honor, not mandated.
No. But that was the practice. I mean, look, you're treating the policy as if it were a statute. There are practices as well as policies, and I understand, but maybe I'm wrong, that the practice was the faculty advisor read the thing before it was published.
I would say that if the Governor's State, as in most universities, I think that's probably right in terms of the practice, reading it, providing advice.
Right. Well, but then if Carter says, I'll read it now because of this turmoil and controversy and the stolen computer and what have you, well, why is that a significant departure from the practice?
I think what Dean Carter did here, Your Honor, was very different. What she did was go behind the backs of these students. If that was really what she wanted to do, she would have gone up front to these students and said, here's what I want to do. She didn't do that. What the record reflects is she went behind their backs, to the outside printer and said, before this is printed, I want to be notified personally. I want the opportunity to review, and I want the opportunity to give approval. That's not someone acting as an advisory role who's looking out for the interests of the paper. That is someone
who is get back to the original issue, which is kind of dropped out. Why wouldn't that support an immunity defense? You know, it's all murky. There's an advisor. The practice is submitted to advisor. Now, for various reasons, Carter doesn't think the advisor should be consulted or what have you, so she puts herself in his place with the differences that you mentioned. But why couldn't she, you know, reading all these confusing cases, think that what she did was permissible? After all, I mean, what is striking, she didn't actually forbid the publication of anything. She just wanted to see it.
Your Honor, given the...
Why couldn't she think? She might think she didn't have the power to censor, but she, like the faculty advisor, could look at the thing and then she could make, you know, forceful representations to the students. You shouldn't publish this. That would be all right.
If that's what she really thought, Your Honor.
What if the faculty advisor said to these students, he reads it before it's published, he says to the students, look, I strongly urge you not to publish this, because if you publish it, you and I and everybody else are going to be sued for libel. Now, would that be a violation of the First Amendment?
If the advisor acting...
Why don't you answer my question? Why don't you answer my question?
That would not be a violation of the First
Amendment. Okay, fine. All right. How different is this?
Very different.
No, in fact, this is a weaker case for you because she didn't say, don't publish this. She never had a chance.
No, what she said was, this will not be published without my approval. The advisor wasn't saying
suppose the next step, if this thing hadn't blown up, is she says to these editors, she says, look, I think it would be a terrible thing for you to publish this. But I realize that, you know, it's your call, and if you want to publish it, go ahead. I will approve it, but I strongly recommend against. That wouldn't be a violation, would it?
Agreed.
Okay, but so far as we know, that is what would have happened if the students hadn't blown up at her.
Your Honor, that's not in the context of this case. When a dean of students, a state actor...
Look, you just said that if she simply had told them, I strongly urge you not to publish this, but it's your call, that would not be a violation of the First Amendment, even though she'd still be Dean Carter. So now you're backtracking on that.
What I'm trying to do, Your Honor, is answer your question.
I don't think so.
That I saw him in this record with what this dean of students did. An experienced dean of students who's been
what's
there.
What's this experienced stuff? If she had just told them, I don't think you should publish this, but I won't forbid you, she would still be experienced. She'd still be the dean of students. But you told me that would not violate the First Amendment.
I think her experience had a lot to do.
Well, but you told me it wouldn't violate the First Amendment. And for all we know, if the students hadn't blown up, that's exactly what would have happened.
Your Honor, again, with due respect, what I'm suggesting to this court is that given the actions that she took, it's very different from the context of the advisory role that you and I were talking about.
But for all we know, she would not have forbidden the publication. She just would have advised them strongly. And that would be all right, you say.
What we know is what the record reflects that this printer said under oath. Mr. Richards said she demanded the right to prior review, and she demanded as a matter of policy the ability to approve.
Yes, precisely. But suppose, again, to repeat, she had said to the students, look, I think you're really dumb to publish this article. We're all going to get into trouble. But, you know, if you insist, all right, I'll tell the printer to go ahead and print it. And then there's no violation of the First Amendment.
No, isn't that last step, though, the one that doesn't happen here? It's the, and then I'll tell the printer it's okay? I thought that was precisely the one thing that the policy of the SCMB did not let the advisor do.
We have no idea what she would have done.
But it doesn't matter. The fact that she's exercising the authority to say, and then you have my go-ahead.
And requiring approval. And I think that's the step that maybe it wasn't articulate.
You mean she, this is like our previous case. You mean when she just says to the printer, I have to approve this, that is the violation of the First Amendment?
I think
Even if she approves it?
Her act of going to and demanding prior approval as a matter of...
That's the violation. But where has there ever been a case where simply an assertion of authority without any exercise of the authority violated the First Amendment?
In the First Amendment area, if the federal government said to the Chicago Tribune, we've decided to read your paper every day and decide whether it can come out, and the record showed that every day they said, yeah, looks fine to us, we're approving it. Could they do that?
Absolutely not.
Well, there's no federal faculty.
I'm just saying that in fact, there's a certain of the right for prior review and approval.
There's no federal faculty advisor, but there is a faculty advisor for this newspaper, and you said it's the practice, which you don't consider to be unconstitutional, that the faculty advisor reads every issue in advance and advises the students of his opinion as to whether it's publishable. And if Dean Carter just did that, you told me, just advised them but didn't prohibit them, that would be okay. But now what you're turning your case on is that for her to tell the printer that she has the power of approval, that's the violation.
And she was requiring that as the way this independent student publication would be distributed.
Now, Mr. Goller, so that I understand this, if all of Dean Carter's actions had been taken by one of the regular faculty advisors, we'd have the same case, you said?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. No question about that, and I appreciate that. If there was any question of any of the judge's mind about that, her actions on behalf of the as the dean of students, I think really exacerbate that. Again, how she acted, going behind the students in this way, I think is just...
That's my question. One of the faculty advisors is selected by the students, right?
Yes.
Okay, a faculty advisor selected by the students does what...
Whoever the state actor was, a dean, a faculty advisor, a faculty member had done these same things. I think we're still in the same boat. I think what makes this case stronger for these students is the dean of students and how she acted. What I was getting about...
Why is it stronger?
I think given the qualified immunity issue, and what I was trying to address really with respect to her experience was, it has to do with what's in her mind as an experienced dean of students in knowing what the state of people's rights were.
Why does the First Amendment depend on what's in her mind or in what way she exercises authority? None of the Supreme Court's cases seems to make anything turn on these matters.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. I think what, again, I'm trying to...
So why should the Constitution make anything turn on them here?
Really reacting to, I think, what some of the state's arguments are about the state of the law being unsettled. And first of all, we would disagree with that for the reasons that are previously cited, but also, again, with respect to what this dean was, the context in which she was operating in the fall of 2000. That's the reason that I raised.
Why isn't it unsettled when you've got this hybrid invitation to have a state actor participate in the student function? Well, why is it so clear that we've got a body of law with this...
I think it has to do with the first question that was asked in this case, Judge, and that is, where's the case that allows this dean to do what she did?
But I was really surprised when you referred to the faculty advisor as a state actor. So I'm following up on Chief Judge Flom's question. You had said earlier that if there were some libel problem or something, there wouldn't be any liability by the university. Now you've identified the faculty advisor as a state actor. So in the libel setting, that would mean he would have passed the newspaper, right? He would have read it, said okay, and then he gets sued for libel.
I think, Your Honor, it's really going to determine, it's going to be fact-based.
No, you said, look, you said earlier that there was no state liability if there was a libel suit against this SCMB or the newspaper itself. Now you're saying the faculty advisor is a state actor. Well, surely the faculty members of the board are state actors. So how do you reconcile that with your strong statement earlier that there would be no libel liability for the state?
If this state actor acts in a way to, if the facts establish that the state actor took certain steps, like Dean Carter did in this case, or took certain steps to do a pre-publication review on an article that was later sued for libel, then maybe that...
Precisely, but we've agreed that the faculty advisor always reads the thing before it goes to the press. So there's always this pre-publication review by what you're calling a state actor.
But again, Your Honor, do the facts indicate that it was done for a libel review or just the layout or just to look at...
What difference does it make?
I think it makes a tremendous amount of difference in terms of what the claims are. It appears that I'm out of time, Your Honors. I certainly appreciate the opportunity again to be here. We would urge affirmance of the district court's denial of the motion for summary judgment.
Well, I think your time had expired, but we gave a couple extra minutes, so you may have 2 minutes for rebuttal. Am I correct on the time? Yes.
To address certain points, I want to make clear one thing. The advisor was and always is appointed by Dean Carter. The advisor is not appointed by the student. In addition, the advisor, the evidence in the record is very clear that the advisor did every time. The common practice was that the advisor would review every single issue. This issue was in fact reviewed by the advisor under the evidence, and that the reasons included libel, poor writing, all the things that Dean Carter said she wanted to look at.
Did the students ever have any input into who the advisor would be? In other words, do the students give the dean a list of individuals?
I don't recall that being in the record, and my guess would be not, because as counsel mentioned, the students here did not like the advisor who took Lefrakad's place. And he was, again, he was no longer on the faculty after, in the fall. His appointment by Dean Carter lasted through December. Of this year. With regard to Judge Posner's first questions about injury, there is no injury here to the plaintiffs from Dean Carter's comments, from Dean Carter's call. The plaintiffs themselves could have easily submitted another paper to the printer, and they just didn't. They never had a paper ready, in fact, to print. Had they done so, this whole problem easily could have gone away. As the court suggested, Dean Carter could have looked at it, said, no, you mean exacerbate, you don't mean mitigate, you mean litigation, you don't mean legislation, and it could have gone forward and nothing would have happened. In addition, the record is clear that the student council, the media board, did not meet and did not approve funding for the paper. So it, as Ms. Poche testified, was the chief deterrent, not Dean Carter, in not having the paper printed. With regard to Judge Wood's comment about whether the University of Chicago could review, I see my time is up.
Let me conclude your thought.
Certainly the University of Chicago would have every right to prevent the students from publishing in the law review defamatory articles. And this court certainly would uphold that. We ask that this court follow its decision in Mueller that a government can have prior review because inadequate remedies, post hoc remedies are inadequate.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess. taken under advisement. This court will stand in recess.